Well, good evening. This morning, I already made one of the things that I so often do. That's a faux pas with my wording. And I thought for a while, especially these young people over here, they just thought, hey, he's really funny. I thought, yeah, I'm in with the young people here. That's really good. But if you listen closely, you'll probably find one of those in at least every sermon. And I just do that on purpose to set you up and see if you'll try to find what it's going to be each time. One of the things I meant to mention this morning and telling you just a little bit about myself, I always think it's important for you to know a little bit about who's speaking. And I told you some things about where I grew up and my background. I didn't mention to you my current situation regarding my family. I'm married to Miss Janice Kelly. She's the greatest woman in the whole world. I'm thoroughly convinced of that. And together we, after having been married for 31 years, we have four children. Three of them are grown and married, and one of them's 14, and he's not married yet. He's still at home. And we have two grandchildren and five great-grandchildren, and one of those statements is not true. You can figure out which one is which. But we do have two grandchildren, and they are living with my oldest son and his wife in Nanning, China, and they're trying to preach the gospel to the largest nation by population in the world, in a place where less than 1% of the people identify as Christians. And it's a great work, and I'd love to talk to you about that if you have any questions about it, and I ask that you keep them in your thoughts and in your prayers. This morning and tonight, we're still trying to sort of clear the ground a little bit in order that faith might be planted and germinate and grow in our lives. And as I said at the end of the service this morning, the fact that you're here tells me that you have at least a hope that this might be true. And I hope that that is your desire. And if you're struggling with your faith, if you question whether or not you can believe this, I hope that tonight's lesson, though I'm sure it's going to be challenging in some ways, will prove to be helpful to you as you seek to grow in your faith and walk with the Lord. The question that I want to ask you tonight has to do with questioning your doubts, and this is the way that I would put it. Have you put your doubts to the same scrutiny as you have your faith? In other words, it's rather popular today for people to scrutinize, to question, to really go after people's faith and their belief and question whether or not that's valid and whether that can be legitimate. But we can turn that upside down as well. We can look at it from the other direction, and sometimes we need to do that, and especially when we begin to find ourselves going down a direction where we're starting to question our faith and question God and question the Bible, and that's, do we put those questions to the same rigorous scrutiny that we have put our faith to? I'm convinced that when we do that, it often really settles us down and brings us back to a place where we need to be. But maybe you're here tonight and you feel like you've kind of seen through why it is that some people need to believe in God. You know, it's a difficult world. It's a difficult life. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of things we don't know. And maybe it just makes people feel more comfortable to believe that there's a God. And you feel like maybe you've seen through all of that. But have you asked yourself the question of why it is that other people sort of need to believe that there isn't a God? That there's something about that that people can sort of find appealing and attractive too. And that's what we're going to explore for a little while this evening. And so what we have to do, and this is true for all of us, this isn't just a challenge to those who are unbelievers or those who are having their doubts and questions. This is a question that all of us need to ask ourselves repeatedly over and over again. Am I being honest? And that's the only way that this lesson, especially this lesson, maybe any lesson that's preached from the Bible, but this lesson for sure, the only way it's going to have any effectiveness with you at all is if you are willing to be as completely honest with yourself as you can possibly be. And here's why that's so important. You've heard of Blaise Pascal. He was sort of an off-the-charts genius. He was a mathematician, a scientist, and a philosopher. And he made a lot of really quotable statements, but this is one of my favorites that he made. He said, people almost always arrive at their beliefs, not on the basis of proof, but on the basis of what they find attractive. And when he talks about beliefs here, he's not specifically referring to religious faith or religious belief. He's just talking about the things that we conclude in life, the way that we see reality, the way that we think things ought to be and go, that usually is something we arrive at as a consequence of our desires, the things we want, not because we're willing to sit down and take a rigorous look at the evidence, but we find something attractive, and then we find arguments that buttress what it was we wanted to believe in the first place. And that's why I say that this lesson in particular is absolutely dependent upon our willingness to be honest and ask ourselves the question, especially tonight, those who are skeptical, those who may be having some serious doubts, am I being completely honest with myself, or have I found some things about distancing myself from the Bible, distancing myself from God's people, from the church, and distancing myself perhaps even from God that I'm sort of finding attractive? Because I have encountered a number of people in life who grew up in a rather conservative church environment, and then they went off to college, as usually when it happens, some period of transition in life, and they got around some people who really weren't that religious and began to involve themselves in certain activities, and they found out that they liked it. They liked it a lot. And it was after that that they began to come up with some pretty good arguments that seemed rather convincing to them as to why, you know, the Bible shouldn't be taken that seriously, Christians are a bunch of hypocrites, and maybe, just maybe, there's really not even that much evidence for the existence of God. And it's very liberating to such people. I remember in particular one young college student. We have tons of college students that come through our congregation through the years because of Western Kentucky University, and just a lot of young people come there to go to school, and I love to get to know these young people. It's the way that I got to know Brent and Katie. They're not young people anymore, but they were once upon a time. I know it's hard for y'all to believe, but they were young college students, and like so many people, they came to Western. I got to know them, but there was one young man in particular, and there's several stories that are kind of like this, but this one stands out in my mind. Who the first semester he was there was just, you know, solid. He was just a great, active, vibrant young man involved in what was going on with the young people at church. And then about the second semester, I noticed that his attendance began to become sporadic. And then when I would find him, he would just have a lot of questions, a lot of doubts. And that's fine. I'm open. I in fact, invite people to ask questions. And yet he was just constantly coming up with one new question after another that suggested that his faith was faltering. And so I went to some of his friends, and I asked them about him. What's going on with so-and-so? And their answer sort of surprised me, because I thought they were going to say, yeah, you know, he's been reading some books, he's been thinking some thoughts, and it seems to be eroding his faith. But that's not what they said at all. Instead, what they said was, yeah, it's kind of sad. He says he's really been going to all the parties and hanging out with some girls that, you know, don't have the best reputation. And he's kind of become known in certain circles as, you know, to really be quite the party animal. So that's what's going on with him. And I was like, okay, now it sort of makes sense. And I'm not saying that's the case in every person's situation. But again, being honest with yourself, if you're having these doubts, if you find yourself drifting away, is it because the evidence has compelled you to go in that direction, or could it be that there's something else that you've found attractive? And now, just like Pascal said, you're finding evidence to support a direction that you already wanted to go in life. Another quote that I'd like to put on the screen comes from Thomas Nagel, who's made himself rather famous. He's a professor at NYU. And he wrote a book more recently called The Mind and the Cosmos, which created quite a stir in the scientific community, because the subtitle of the book, and you probably can't read this, but it was why the materialist neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. Now, he's an atheist, and yet he's saying this Darwinian theory, the hard evolutionary theory of the materialist view of the universe, he said, it just doesn't work, and we have got to come up with some sort of alternative explanation, which I thought was a very honest thing for someone like him to say. But it's not this book that I want to mention. It's another one that he wrote a little bit earlier, in which he makes this quote. He says, it isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my beliefs. It's that I hope there's no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Again, this is the kind of openness that I think is, in that regard, commendable. At least he's able to identify this reality, that there's a desire, there's a motive that often drives our beliefs. One last quotation on this goes way back to Aldous Huxley, who made this famous statement. He said, "I had a motive for not wanting the world to have a meaning. Consequently, assumed that it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption." So he began with the assumption and the desire, I don't want the universe to have a God, I don't want it to have a meaning or a purpose, and then he said it was pretty easy to come up with proofs or reasons to satisfy that desire or assumption. He goes on, "For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, both sexual and political." You know, the truth of the matter is that most of us, as human beings, are really not so much on a truth quest. We like to say, I want to know the truth, and I'm willing to follow the evidence wherever it will lead me. But the fact of the matter is, very, very few of us are really genuinely on a truth quest. We're on a happiness quest, let's be honest. People want to be happy. They want to feel good. They want to feel fulfilled. And what we tend to do is find whatever philosophy of life best suits that desired end is the one that we're going to find the proof and the evidence for. And that's true in so many ways in life, not just religious. I remember as a teenager having numerous, I don't know if arguments, but discussions with my parents. And often it would be around something that I wanted to do or a party that I wanted to attend or a place that I wanted to go. And I would come to my parents and I would never once sit down with them and say, "Mom and Dad, I know y'all have more experience in life than I do. I know that you love me. You probably love me more than I love myself. And I've got an opportunity to do this, that, or the other. And I want to find out what's the best thing for me. I want to find out what's the truth and the right thing to do. And I was wondering if I could just lay everything about this on the table and y'all help me come to the right, the true, the best conclusion." I didn't do that one single time I remember as a teenager growing up. You probably didn't either. And sometimes I get in a discussion with someone at church, or maybe it's with my wife, sometimes even with my kids, and we'll be having a bit of a back and forth. And somewhere in the middle of this discussion, it sort of dawns on me. A light will click, and I'm kind of like, oh, she's right. And it's the hardest thing in the world to just stop right there and say, okay, I get your point. I was wrong. I was mistaken. You've made your case. I think you're right. We just hardly ever do that. Instead, we just keep pushing forward, and maybe if we can come up with the right zinger or just raise our voice a little bit louder than the other person, or if we're just a little bit more articulate than they are, then we can come up with the win, as it were, in the argument, because that's what we want. We want an outcome. We want to win the argument. We want things to go the way and the direction that we desire. We're not after the truth. And so if we're going to answer the biggest question that the human being can possibly ask, is there a God and what is his will for my life? The only way we're ever going to arrive at that conclusion in a way that is true is to be absolutely honest with ourselves and with our motives. So let's take a look and see what's going on. Let's take a peek inside our hearts. In our class this morning, if you were here for Bible class, we talked about the Word of God as a mirror. And in it, we find a reflection of our true selves. And nowhere is that truer than in the Apostle Paul's letter to the church at Rome, in which he writes this, beginning in chapter 1, I've missed a few things here, but beginning in chapter 1, in verse 19 and 20, he writes, "For what can be known about God is plain to them." He's talking about people who've turned away from the living God, the true God, and gone after the false gods of their time, the ones we talked about this morning and such like. And he says, "But what can be known about God is plain to them." There's some plain things that we can all know about God. And we can know them because, he says, God has shown them to us. 4, his invisible attributes. There's certain qualities about God that are invisible, but yet they can be known, and he identifies them here as his eternal power and his divine nature. And he says that this is how we can know them, because they have been clearly perceived, they've been clearly revealed and clearly perceived by us ever since the creation of the world. And the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Who has an excuse to deny the existence and the power and the divinity of God? According to this passage, Paul says no one has an excuse to deny it. And the reason why we can't deny it is because the evidence is actually overwhelming. He's saying when you look around the world that God has created, the evidence of a creator is so overwhelming that there is no excuse ultimately for not believing in God. That doesn't mean you don't have some questions. That doesn't mean some things are going to pop up that we can't quite get our minds around and square. But we don't let those kinds of things override the overwhelming body of evidence that is shouting at us for the existence of God. And this goes way, way back. Thousands of years ago, the poet said in the book of Psalms that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. There's so many ways in which God reveals himself to us, both within our human nature and also at the external world that we're able to look around at. I was listening to someone a while back give a lecture talking about all of the different things that are absolutely essential in order for life to exist on planet Earth. And over the years, and especially in the last 10 to 20 years, because of our advances in scientific studies and in the instrumentation that we have, the more overwhelming and large the number of specific things that have to be just so in order for life to exist at all on this planet, that it's absolutely mind-boggling. And I don't understand all of this, and you don't understand, many of you don't understand all this either, but all these scientists agree that if the speed of light, what that has to do with life, you know, again, I don't know, but the speed of light, if it were just the smallest degree different than what it is, life would not be possible. If the gravitational constant were just a little bit stronger or a little bit weaker, life would not be possible. If the strong and weak nuclear forces, again, whatever that is, were just a little bit different than they are, then things would not adhere together in such a way as to make life possible. The information that is contained in such an ordered way in the DNA of most living things, but of human beings in particular, is so absolutely complex that it boggles the mind of the most sophisticated people in the world today. And that information doesn't just come together by accident. We look at this world and the fingerprints of God are all over it. And I believe that if we're honest with ourselves, even though we have some doubts, even though there's some things we can't answer, we'll come to the conclusion that there has to be a creator. Something that just kind of blew me away, and I don't know, this is not an argument for God. It's just one of those kind of weird things that makes you go, huh? I don't know how big a deal it was this far south, but last summer, back in 2017, the eclipse that came across the United States, it just, the one of the places where the viewing of it was the very best was about 20 miles south of Bowling Green, where I live. And so we went down to where my daughter lives, right there at the, you know, the very path of the totality, as they called it. And I was really kind of prepared to be underwhelmed, which is always a good thing in life. I've found if, you know, prepared to be disappointed and life just goes so much better. But it was absolutely amazing. And afterwards, I just got all this interest in reading about the eclipse and stuff. And one of the things that I found out is that the sun is exactly 400 times larger than the moon. And it is exactly 400 times, from Earth's point of view, 400 times further away than the moon. So that in these unlikely events, but that do happen from time to time, that they cross paths, they line up absolutely perfectly, where the moon perfectly, with nothing overlapping and nothing left as a remainder matches up with the sun. And again, that's just amazing. But there are so many things in life that are sort of like that, that just give us this sense that something is going on. John Leslie does a great job of illustrating this, because sometimes you come up with these hundreds or thousands of things that are absolutely essential for life to exist in this world. And still, someone who is inclined to not believe it will say, well, that doesn't prove anything. It still could just happen. And that, theoretically, that's true. But what John Leslie says, if you were placed in front of a firing squad with 100 marksmen, trained marksmen, standing just 10 yards away, all with their rifles pointed directly at you, and there was a ready aim fire. And a moment later, you opened your eyes, and you weren't on the other side. You were still standing right there, and you look down, and there's not a hole in you. There's two possible conclusions that you can reach. Number one, you could say, wow, what a coincidence, 100 trained marksmen at point-blank range, and every one of them just missed. And that's theoretically possible. But it would be a much, much more reasonable thing to say, wow, there's something else going on here. They missed on purpose. There was some reason, there was something else going on than just the sheer coincidence that they all missed. And when we look at all the evidence for God, we have to come to this conclusion, I believe, if we're honest and reasonable, that there's something going on in this world. And that's what Paul says right here in Romans 1. And we don't have an excuse, really. There's really no excuse for us to look at ourselves as human beings and the complexity and the values and morality and ethics and the ability we have to appreciate beauty and look out at the world and all of the evidence that is there for us to deny God. It's clearly revealed. And we can perceive it if we're open to do so. So why do we do this? Why are we tempted to deny God the way that we do? And I think that part of the reason for that is because if there is a God, then one of the problems that we have is that if God exists, then I'm guilty. Because here's what he says in Romans 1, verse 18. The wrath of God, the anger of God, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And as he says later in the book, in chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. God created man for a purpose and with a reason, with a design, and with a desire to have a relationship with them and for them to have relationships with one another and to manifest his love and his glory in this world. Yet man has consistently rebelled against his Creator, suppressed his knowledge of God in order that he might distance himself from God and do his own thing. And often in the pursuit of doing his own thing and pursuing his own interest and his own desires, runs roughshod and does harm, great harm at times, to other people who bear God's image. When God looks at the horrible things that people do to each other, he becomes angry, and justifiably so. And he's angry as well because we are suppressing this truth that we ought to know. And so people deny God because if God, then I'm accountable. Be honest. Is that the case for you? If you've got these doubts, if you're thinking about walking away from God, walking away from the church, walking away from the Bible, forgetting about Jesus, isn't part of that because you know that if God, then I'm accountable to someone but myself? And I'd rather just hold on to this illusion of autonomy, that I'm my own person, that I'm answerable to no one, that there's no one who has given me life, who's actually taking an interest in what I'm doing and how I'm spending the life that he has given me. I'm just on my own, and it's up to me to do anything and everything that I want to, and whatever I can pursue and whatever I can get away with, that's just on me. People want that. People have been wanting that. The Bible tells us that people have been wanting that since Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. When Satan told them the lie that God doesn't really love you, God's not really taking care of you, and what you need to do is you need to take this fruit for yourself. You need to take this for yourself, and you need to begin to determine for yourself good and evil instead of being subject to God. Doesn't that drive our desire very often to question whether or not he's even there? And not only if God, then I'm accountable, but if God, I'm guilty. And I know we don't like these words, but that's the reality. If God, and I look at my life and the things that I've done in the past, I know I'm guilty. I'm speaking firsthand right now. I'm telling you that if God, Lawrence Kelly is guilty. I've done some things, I've said some things that if God had had a video camera recording that event, or if somebody had hired someone to video me everywhere I went and they were to play it on the screen today at my worst moment, I'd be absolutely humiliated. And you would too. And yet there's a God in heaven who sees everything, who knows our hearts as well as our deeds. And if he's there, I'm guilty. And that feeling of guilt can become so powerful for us, it becomes such a motive for us that we just will do anything to deny that he's even there. I don't want to be accountable, and I surely do not want to be guilty, and so we just go on. But think about it. These are arguments. Really, they're not arguments. They're responses, aren't they, to our desires. They're not arguments against God. They're responses to our desires. What I want to ask you to do is to think about it a little bit differently. Look at it this way. If God, then there's meaning. Okay? If God, there's meaning. If no God, there's no meaning. And to me, this is a huge thing. And I listen to different writers and authors and speakers and skeptics and atheists talk about this problem because it is a huge problem for atheism. And they just try to approach it and say, yeah, you know, ultimately there's no meaning, but, you know, I can still sort of pretend, I can kind of extract some meaning and make myself think that something matters. But look, just be honest. If there's no God, if there's no ultimate being, and we're just all a cosmic accident, if we're just a material universe that's here for a little while, that came into existence for no reason, for no purpose, and ultimately is going to wind its way down, the energy's going to run out, and everything's going to fade to black, and there will be no one there to remember anything that anyone ever did, then ultimately what that means is my life is meaningless. And the idea that it has some meaning or purpose is entirely an illusion that I've created. And I don't think that any culture or society can ever be sustained on that basis for very long without falling and collapsing into absolute nihilism. And there's no comfort, there's no hope in that point of view. But if God, there's meaning. If God, there's someone who's watching me. And he's not watching me because he wants to find fault or because he wants to kick me in the head. There's a God who created me because he loved me and because he longs for a relationship with me. And because he is a God who cares and who has invested himself emotionally in what I do, that means that my life matters. And because of the promise that he has that I can live with him for eternity, my life doesn't just matter in the here and now. It can matter on and on forever. And so don't trade the illusion of autonomy when you can have meaning and purpose and value in your life. And if God, there's not just guilt, there's forgiveness. If God, there is forgiveness. Paul goes on in this great letter to the church at Rome to talk to them in chapter 5, and I don't have this on PowerPoint, but he says, you know, when we were still weak, verse 6, when we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person, one would even dare to die. but God shows his love for us and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath to come. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more now shall we be reconciled, shall we be saved by his life. More than that, we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we now have received reconciliation. The purpose of our existence is relationship with God and with each other. Those are the things that matter most, and you know it. And I know it. And the purpose of Christianity is reconciliation. Relationship is why you were created. Relationship with your Creator, relationship with your fellow man, all of which has been horribly marred and broken by our sin, and yet God in his grace has made a way for us to be reconciled to him through his Son Jesus, whom he gave for us. And we can have that reconciliation with God, and when we find that peace and reconciliation with God, it opens up a whole new world of peace and reconciliation with our brothers and sisters, with our fellow man. We can find peace there as well. God, there is endless possibility. And so what do? If you've come here tonight, you've had doubts and questions, maybe you still do, but you're willing to honestly acknowledge that what's driving some of those doubts is a desire for autonomy, a desire not to feel guilty, but you see that in God there is meaning and there's forgiveness, and that's what you want. And what do? I love the book of James. Jesus' younger, bold little brother, who himself wasn't really a follower or believer in Jesus, at least not as the Son of God, until after he saw Jesus risen from the dead. I mean, what would it take to convince you that your brother is the Son of God? Probably only one thing. If you saw him die and then you saw him alive again, okay, you win. And that's exactly what we learn with James. And so he writes this book. And he uses some words that are a little bit different than us, and maybe even off-putting to us, but I think if we'll be careful and pay attention, we'll see how beautiful what he has to say is. He says in James chapter 4, verse 8, that we need to come near to God, and he'll come near to you. You know, God's already taken the first step. It's not like God's in heaven with his hands folded, waiting for you to take the first step. He's already come here. He's come here in the person of his Son and given his life for you. And now he's just pleading with you to respond, to draw near to him. And the moment you take that step to turn toward him, he draws even closer to you. And the whole purpose of your existence, the purpose of your life, the purpose of your being is now enriched infinitely because you have a relationship with the God who made you, who redeems you, who loves you. So that's what you need to do. You need to come near to God. He'll come near to you. Does he just seem so far away? How can I believe in a God who just seems so remote? Well, try to take a step. And maybe you can't get all the way there in one step, but you can take one step tonight, one step closer to God, by at least being honest. And the next thing he says is that we need to wash our hands, you sinners, because we've sinned. Again, if we're honest, we know it, and we can purify our hearts. You're double-minded. We need to become singular in our faith and our trust in God. Quit holding on to our rebellion and our sin and just say, you know, I know that that's destructive. I know that hurts me. It hurts other people. It denies God the glory that he richly deserves for having made me and redeemed me. And so I'm done with that. I'm going to pursue God with a single-minded focus, purpose and determination. I'm done living a life that's double-minded. And then lastly, and I think the greatest part of the whole verse, humble yourselves. This tells us a whole lot, doesn't it, about why we resist this, because humility does not come natural to any of us. Humble ourselves. Humble ourselves before the Lord. And he doesn't ask you to humble yourself just so he can keep you down, but because he knows that's the only way that there can ever actually be this true reconciliation. Humble yourself so that he can reach down and and He'll lift you up. And once you are lifted up by God, once you are reconciled to God, once you know that your sins have been forgiven in Christ, you won't miss your doubts, you won't miss your denials, you won't miss your rejection of God at all. If we can help you in any way tonight to respond to the gospel, to respond to the Lord Jesus' invitation, to come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. We'd be delighted to help you in any way that we can while together we stand and sing to Him.